what drove inflation, the process that solves the horizon and flatness problems and seeds initial density variations. The second is what happened after inflation. So evidence for domination by radiation only extends as far back as the time of neutrino decoupling. There's no particular reason to believe that the radiation that the universe was radiation dominated all the way from inflation. In particular, any kind of heavy relic would have come to naturally dominate the universe, and it only observationally is required to decay into radiation by 1 second. This is a picture of that scenario, density plotted against time. And so some well-motivated examples of such an early matter species include the moduli fields in, predicted by string theories, a hidden sector mediator particle, or the inflaton itself. And finally, what is dark matter? So these questions can leave clues in dark matter density variations, which are reflected in the power in the matter power spectrum, which is plotted here, power against scale. So here I have some examples of inflationary models. Here we have an example of what an early matter dominated era does. In particular, since the early matter species clusters, this enhances small scale density variations. And finally, we can have the imprint of dark matter either from the free streaming scale or from Poisson noise. So my research uses the first and smallest dark matter halos to probe otherwise inaccessibly small sub-kiloparsec scales. The idea here is we want to connect the microhalo population to the linear theory power spectrum that I just showed you. Now the difficulty here is that we're looking at a deeply nonlinear regime, so we have to use simulations to really understand what's happening. But microhalos, the smallest halos are too small to simulate up to the present day in full context because of the difference in scales between the smallest and largest structures. So my answer to this problem is to use a combination of simulations and analytic arguments to develop semi-analytic models of the formation and evolution of these halos. Now, halo models already exist, so why don't I just use, say, press sector with a concentration mass relationship? Well, first we want substructure. Most microhalos today would be subhalos of larger halos. Second, we just saw that there are a variety of different shapes for the power spectrum. We want a model that's valid for an arbitrary power spectrum. So this rules out the empirical concentration mass relationships. And finally, we want to account for the non-universal density profile of halos. So in particular, hierarchical assembly produces the classic NFW or Ainasto density profiles, but the first halos form by direct collapse of overdense regions, and these develop density profiles that have density proportional to radius to the minus 3/2 in the inner region. So this is a plot. This is a density profile of a halo, and if you notice the scaling here, a flat line here means density is proportional to radius to the minus 3/2 power. So these are my simulations, but a number of other people have also seen this. Now,
so can you describe the simulations? I mean, like so normally this regime is like super hard to simulate.
Yes. The idea is you want to resolve the free streaming cutoff. So in a usual power spectrum that would look that would look pretty flat, you end up first halos form, and then very rapidly you get larger structures, so you can't get very far. Now this is the scenarios that I've been studying. If we look back at these power spectra, for example, this scenario, you can actually simulate these halos that form at this scale for a long time, and so that's the kind of picture that I looked at to produce this plot.
I see. Because it's a much bluer power spectrum.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I see.
And you're saying all of these people agree that that's the shape of the profile.
Yes. Now a lot of them are
super blue before the cutoff. I mean.
So That's what I'm studying, that they're very blue before the cutoff. Not all, so many of these are simply looking at a flatter power spectrum like CDM, and then just not simulating very long. And so there are questions as to whether this profile is applicable in that scenario. Is that your question?
Yeah. So you don't trust other people, but you trust this.
Well, I trust this result for the particular scenario that I've been looking at. And I think it's valid at least transiently for CDM. The question is whether it lasts.
Sorry, what is the scale of the radius? You scale it with...
Right, so that depends strongly on what power spectrum you're looking at. It's going to be comparable to wherever the largest...
I mean, so you showed the plot to... so the radius should be something.
Even the units of radius is obviously
the units of the radius.
Yeah.
Yes. So it depends on the cosmological scenario, but you could be looking at a co-moving scale about here, and then the physical scale is fixed by the time associated with this particular amplitude when it collapses. So we might be looking at something like. For certain early matter dominated scenarios, you could be looking at, say, a solar system scale for this radius. Okay, and then just as a quick note, this density profile has been assumed in a number of previous works that used the first halos to probe small scale power, but I showed and this other work showed that it doesn't arise from a Gaussian field. It actually requires an overdense region without any surrounding underdense space.
Sorry.
Yes.
I missed that.
Oh.
This is Birchinger.
That's the Birchinger black hole solution.
So when you say does not arise from Gaussian random field, you think that doesn't arise, or
the Birchinger solution doesn't arise?
The Birchinger solution. Yes.
Okay.
So my approach is to consider the unfiltered density field and map each peak at early times into a collapsed halo at later times. And the idea is going to be to use the structure of the peak to predict the structure of the halo. Now, this connection is going to be, to figure out this connection, it's useful to look at how these halos form, how the first halos form. So this is a plot of the density profile at different times. So shortly after collapse, we see that it looks like this green line.
Define collapse here, sorry.
So this is the collapse predicted by ellipsoidal collapse theory. So it's when the shells cross, but it's when the last axis crosses. So in spherical collapse theory, it would be when do the collapsing shells cross initially?
So Wandenmayer's kind of visits, are we?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So we see that the inner asymptote is established very quickly after this collapse within one dynamical time, and then the outer density profile it transitions to a steeper slope as the accretion slows. So this suggests that we should use two different models to model to describe each regime for the inner asymptote. Well, since it's set at the formation time, it can only be sensitive to the immediate neighborhood of the density peak, specifically its height and its curvature. Now, for the larger, the greater density profile is going to be sensitive to the broader density peak. But it turns out that since accretion is slow in this regime, we can use already established secondary infall models, and that I found that they work pretty well. Now, for the inner asymptote, it turns out that a simple scaling argument works well. The idea is that we have the peak height, which is going to be associated with a collapse time, and the derivatives, the curvature of the peak, which is going to be associated with a characteristic scale. We want to predict this quantity, this A here, which has dimensions of density times radius to the 3/2 power. So to get density, we want collapse time to the -3 power, or peak height cubed, to get a length scale. Well, we can get this. This is a natural co-moving length scale. Scale it to a physical length. And then we're done, except we can also add an ellipsoidal correction. And this is how it works. So, so here I'm plotting the asymptotic coefficient measured in simulations against the prediction. So each of these points here is a halo. Well, it's a halo on the y-axis and a peak on the x-axis. And what I'm showing in this plot is that it works for a wide variety of different power spectra. Now, I should note that there are thousands of points here, so the outliers are visually overrepresented. Here I have a density plot.
So can I ask something?
Yes.
How did you get r to the minus 3 halves? Is that something that you argued on?
It's since we're trying to predict this quantity, this has to have dimensions of density times radius to the 3 halves.
Yes, he's not trying to predict the exponent. He's just taking that as an input, I think.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you not have an argument for why it should be r to the minus?
I do not. So that's something that is found in simulations, but I don't understand why it happens. We don't understand why it happens exactly.
Okay. So then, if you don't understand that, whatever you have for A is more of, you say, it's the dimensional argument, I guess.
This is the dimensional argument. Yes.
Where this delta and this like Laplacian of delta, that's all being evaluated on some smoothing scale.
No, so this is the unfiltered density field. So we're assuming there's a free streaming cutoff. You're looking at at those scales.
I see. Okay, yeah. So smoothing on the free streaming scale. I see.
Yeah. Now, these all describe halo formation during matter domination, but certain early universe scenarios, if they boost the power spectrum sufficiently, they can actually induce collapse before matter dominates. Now, the question is, can halos form during radiation domination? Since there are since radiation doesn't cluster, there are no net forces, but these overdensities, these density contrasts still grow during radiation domination just due to convergent particle drift left over from either a previous epoch or from horizon entry. So to study this scenario, I modified the Gadget 2 simulation code to represent an early matter dominated era. So this is a scenario that could easily cause a collapse during radiation domination. The idea here is that the mass of each simulation particle. So each simulation particle is going to represent both the early matter species and the dark matter. And I'm going to make the mass a function of time. Although as a technical matter, it turns out to be better to implement this by scaling a time integrand for particle kicks. That works out better for discrete time steps. And here's a simulation result. So this is plotting density against radius. So it's a density profile. These solid lines are dark matter. These horizontal dashed lines are radiation. So the radiation density is coming down relative to dark matter. This is all relative density. So we see that when the dark matter is less dense than the radiation, we can have a very dense structure, but it's still not bound. It's just from all this matter being drifting together. But once the dark matter density locally starts to exceed the radiation density, you can get a bound halo. And this is still happening a long time before global matter domination. So these halos would be extremely dense, and you can pretty severely constrain their abundance. Now, my models have been predicting the initial density profiles of microhalos and in ice.
Yes. So this is so dark matter here means like the same dark matter that we have at redshift.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So at the time you're talking about the mean matter density is less than the radiation.
Yeah. So here's the mean matter density. We're just keeping it fixed. Mean dark matter density, and then the radiation density is coming down relative to it.
And that's the evolution of the dark matter profile?
Yes.
Those colors corresponding to those times?
Yes.
Wait, and so 10 years after the Big Bang, you're saying radiation is only 100 times more than the matter density?
Yeah.
Okay, somehow, okay. That sounds a bit...
So here we have what A goes is...
like, so matter radiation quality...
Is that like 52,000
years?
52,000
years. 52,000
years.
And T goes as A squared. So.
Don't try to do it now.
Yeah, I think it works.
I mean, this... Yeah, the numbers don't matter too much, but it's... obviously, I did this all in redshifts and then converted it to times for readability.
So by how much do you need to boost the power spectrum to get this to happen?
It's... So, okay, it's a lot. it depends... I guess I don't have a particular number for that, but it would be pretty easy to work out. Basically, if you're normally forming halos around redshift 50, you need to boost by at least like a factor of 100, which would be 10,000 in power spectrum. So these models are predicting the initial density profiles of microhalos, which are static in isolation. But most microhalos aren't going to remain isolated. So as they merge, their profiles are going to evolve. And how can we understand that evolution? So there are two main processes to consider. One is mergers between microhalos. So this is something I'm planning to study. I haven't studied in detail yet, but I do have an approximate treatment that I found works in simulations. And that's that the sum of these squared inner asymptotes over all halos, sum over all halos, is approximately conserved. So in addition to being borne out in simulations, this behavior makes sense conceptually in that this A squared is dimensionally density times mass. Masses are going to be additive in mergers. So if you assume that the density is preserved, which is a result that other people have seen, then this A squared should also be additive. And this is a useful result if you're thinking about dark matter annihilation, because the annihilation rate is proportional to A squared. Now, the second process is going to be that these microhalos are going to accrete onto larger structures. So we want to think about subhalo evolution due to tidal forces and encounters with other objects. Is there a question about this before I move on?
So you're saying that the annihilation doesn't change under merger? Is that what this annihilation rate?
Yes. Yes.
I'm still catching up. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're saying that the end result of merging together all these little microhalos is that the slope stays the same, so does R to the minus 3/2.
So that's actually a tricky thing, because the slope also changes, and I don't quite understand how that happens. So that's something I'm planning to look into. But if you don't merge, right, that's a good question. So if you don't merge too many, then it's staying pretty close to minus 3/2. So if you just measure it, assuming that it's, like in the simulation, assuming that it's 3/2, then this works out.
Okay.
So to study tidal evolution, I carried out a series of simulations with an N-body microhalo orbiting an analytic host, and I have a movie here. Now, I should note that I implemented this in a non-standard way. I instead of actually having an analytic host, I'm applying the time-dependent tidal forces directly. And the advantage to this is that it avoids any numerical artifacts associated with the scale difference between these tiny microhalos and the huge host. Now, a key qualitative result is this. So we have applied the density profile at various different times, and we see that the central cusp persists. So we're really thinking about the subhalos being gradually diminished but not destroyed. Now, okay, so how do we model this evolution? Well, any kind of model is going to be a function of the host subhalo system, which has, in this picture, two subhalo parameters, two host parameters, two orbital parameters, and a time parameter. So we can easily reduce this to four parameters, but it's actually very helpful to reduce these parameters in a clever way. So here are the parameters that I have come up with. The first one is the relative energy injection. So the energy injection into subhalo particles relative to their binding energy per orbit about the host, computed using the impulse approximation. And here's a picture of how that works, how much this improves the situation. So this is a plot on the y-axis of some particular parameter of the model. We'll see what it ends up being. It's basically the decay rate of a subhalo property. And here we have a more naive parameterization. And this is what happens when we use this energy parameterization. So what happens is these different, the residual shape dependence, which is indicated by the colors, is mostly removed. Second parameter is going to be the ratio between the orbital radius and the host's scale radius. And this sets the directions of tidal forces, whether they're compressive or stretching. In particular, if you're much below the scale radius for an NFW host, you only have compressive tidal forces. Third parameter is a little bit tricky. So we still need to take into account the shape of the orbit. And the idea here is that the shape of the orbit is connected to the time scale over which tidal forces change. And this matters because due to the conservation of adiabatic invariance, energy can only be injected where the time scale for the energy injection is shorter than the internal dynamical time scale. And so this means that the smaller radii within the subhalo are going to be adiabatically shielded. And then this affects how the shape of the density profile of the subhalo evolves due to the tidal evolution. And then finally, instead of time, we'll use the number of orbits. Questions? Okay. So here's my model. We're going to look at the dark matter annihilation rate, which is proportional to this J factor, the volume integral of density squared. But the story is similar for other properties. So here's my main evolution equation, essentially saying that, so n is the number of orbits. It's essentially saying that the fractional change in J per orbit is equal to this thing, which I'll talk about in a moment. But this is roughly what that evolution looks like. This is a plot of J against time. And here is what the rate looks like. So I'm plotting just that quantity. And you can see that this power law behavior is borne out.
And what are B and C?
I'm about to get into that. So this coefficient B, this is essentially the initial decay rate for J. It depends on the energy injection per orbit and the direction of tidal forces. Now, this second factor here, this is related to the change in the shape of the density profile, and that's illustrated pretty nicely here. The idea is that the blue is the more circular orbit. So the more circular orbit has the outskirts stripped more, but the interior is adiabatically shielded. So after you've removed most of the outskirts, you're losing efficiency because it's still difficult to strip the shielded interior. And so that's why the rate of tidal stripping is going down more quickly than with a more radial orbit. And then finally, the evolution is going to be fixed by an overall scale, which is related to the tidal compression or stretching of the subhalo without any regard for actual mass loss. And so that's going to be related to the direction and the strength of tidal forces. So that's that model. Now, I've also studied the impact of encounters with other objects, specifically stars. And I modified the simulation code to apply the velocity injections induced by a series of stellar encounters. And I have a movie of that here. You can actually, if you look closely, see some of the stellar encounters.
You don't show stars there, do you?
So I'm not showing any stars. I'm applying the velocity injections due to the encounters. You can see there was one there. one there. And I developed a model. So if you look at this line, it's actually matching up with the simulation. So the solid, this is a particular subhalo parameter, how it's evolving in time. Solid line is the model prediction, dots are simulations. So it, predictions are working well. And so these models establish the connection between the microhalo population and the linear theory power spectrum. And I've considered two applications. So the first is breaking a degeneracy between dark matter and the early universe. So early matter domination vastly broadens the range of viable thermal relic dark matter candidates, because the decay of this early matter species is sourcing radiation that dilutes the dark matter. So you need more dark matter. It needs to have a smaller cross-section to freeze out at higher abundance. And here's a picture of what that looks like. So this is annihilation cross-section plotted against mass. And this blue curve is what you'd get if the dark matter freezes out during the last radiation-dominated epoch. But an early matter-dominated era actually allows everything within this white area. Now, okay, so this is a problem for indirect detection searches that are just starting to probe this blue line. How are you going to get all of this? Well, fortunately, an early matter-dominated era also boosts density variations, as I've discussed. So this is a picture of the power spectrum. We can see that the precise amount of the boost depends on free-streaming properties in relation to the reheat scale. But the end result of this is that you get early, highly dense microhalos. Their density boosts annihilation rates and allows improved indirect detection bounds. And so this is my result for this scenario. And so that allows you to actually look pretty deeply into that allowed region. You can actually also there's also potential to detect the signature of an early matter dominant era by looking at galactic systems. And the idea here is that, well, the microhalo distribution roughly follows the dark matter distribution, but it's a little bit different because of evolution due to tidal effects or encounters. So you actually end up with a different morphology if you were looking at the dark matter distribution, which is what you would see from dark matter decay, which is a totally different process. You would see this black curve. So this is particularly looking at the Draco dwarf. But because of the suppression of subhalo annihilation rates within this system, depending on what scenario you're looking at, you can actually get a curve with a different shape.
So how dense are these things, you know, relative to like stars?
Yes. How dense are these halos?
Yeah.
Yes. So it depends on the scenario, but for this scenario, they're going to be around 10 to the 12 solar mass per kiloparsec cubed, which is, so the mean cosmological density is like 40.
No. I mean, you know, like relative to like, you know, stellar tides, I guess, is what matters, right?
Stellar tides.
Like, so stars have like a solar mass and they're spaced by what, like a parsec or something, roughly.
Right. So that could be like a solar mass per parsec cubed. So 1,000 solar masses per kilo.
10 or something, right?
It's not as much as the parsec. Why do you say solar density? Yeah. You mean?
He's saying the spacing.
Density of a star, right?
The spacing, right?
The spacing of a star is parsec. Okay, so that's
And so you were saying what these things are.
Like 10 to the 12 solar mass per kiloparsec cubed. So if you're thinking of a star every parsec, that would be like 10 to the 9, right?
Okay, so therefore then these things are like way denser than the typical tidal fields. So then I would think the stars don't really affect them much, and then why then?
Right. So they do. It's we're also going over like 10 gigayears. So we're looking at encounters over this whole duration.
Like, were there more encounters in the past or something?
No,
in the past?
It's just a lot. So each encounter has an effect. And then you can also randomly have closer encounters that have a much bigger effect. So when you add all these effects together, you end up with a noticeable but not huge suppression. So there's no radius where the star is going to pass and it doesn't have any effect at all. I mean, in principle, there could be because of because of the time scales.
Right.
But yeah.
But if like the typical density of stars is like 1,000 times smaller than the relative densities here, I can have 1,000 encounters. I don't care, right? I mean, yeah. So I guess I'm just failing to see like why there's any effect. But okay, we shouldn't.
Okay. Yeah. This is what I mean. It's what I've predicted using this model. And in combination, so this isn't just stars. It's also the tidal effects, but they're actually pretty comparable in effect.
Oh, okay. Like assuming that different like microhalos passing by each other, they might like.
So it actually I have worked out that the microhalo encounters don't have as much of an effect. So I've neglected them. But this is encounters with stars and the effect of the tides from the host.
Yeah, but that's small. Okay, yeah, I mean, like...
Yeah, I mean, it's always...
The density of our halo is tiny compared to these densities, so...
Yes.
So therefore it shouldn't be relevant, so yeah. I guess I'm missing something.
So it's relevant So it's a small effect. I mean, we're not saying... It's not an order unity effect, otherwise you would get suppressed down to near zero. But it is a noticeable effect.
Are you sure it's 10 to the 12 solar mass per kiloparsec cube? That sounds a bit too high.
That's, yeah. Okay, so now a second application is probing inflation through its imprint on the power spectrum of primordial curvature fluctuations. And here I have a plot of existing constraints on the power spectrum. So up here we have precise measurements from the CMBN structure. At smaller scales, we only have upper bounds. But the smallest dark matter halos can supply they're the strongest probes of the power spectrum at sub-kiloparsec scales. So this green curve is from my work. It's actually using dark matter annihilation, which of course assumes a particular dark matter model. So I'm planning to consider gravitational signatures as well. And this is Nyayesh. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, if no other questions, then we can meet in the dinner time.
Thank you.